Coming up now at 8:15, good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Summit County Council met yesterday in the studio to talk about some of those issues discussed. I have County Council Member Roger Armstrong. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Leslie.
Major topic certainly was concern over the fairgrounds master plan. Why are you concerned that the master plan, even when built out, may not have enough room to grow?
Well, we wanted to make sure that, you know, the current fairgrounds is actually very cramped, and for years we weren't even able to have carnival rides. Travis English came in, and over the last couple of years, we've at least been able to add a couple of those things. I think the fair has really been upgraded since he's taken charge of it. And that's got people excited. We're looking for some economic drivers to help things out in North Summit County. So it seems like there's a real opportunity here to do that. At the same time, the price tag that landed in front of us is somewhere between $11 million and $15 million. And as Chris asked the question last night, and I think it was confirmed, we can't recall that we've ever paid that much for anything in the county before. So if we're really looking at writing anything close to that kind of check, we need to make sure that we're getting it right. And we had some input last night from Cliff Blonquist that was, he was concerned that the way the rodeo grounds are laid out, especially in terms of parking for participants, that it may be insufficient. And if that's the case, if there's not convenience, they may not come. So we could actually shrink one of the most popular parts of the fair if we don't get that right. There was a lot of input about the area where the stream / river runs through and whether we could upgrade that to make that an amenity rather than just essentially a ditch. And I think that we just need to do some more work. I don't think the thing is all the way cooked. So before we step off this, we want to make sure that we're not going to build a very expensive facility and that it's going to be limited once we get it completed. I mean, it'll be limited anyway because we don't have a great amount of land there to work with, but let's optimize what we have.
So we're not talking about moving, you know, getting bigger in the future. I mean, if that's the case, we're still going to need more land.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we've added a substantial amount of land. So if it's only to protect the size of what we had before, I'm not sure that makes sense. I mean, it was cramped. So we'll be able to add some more rides. We need to replace the ball field that's there because it's there. We can't take that amenity away from the community without replacing it. The Quonset Hut was built by the Lions Club. We have to replace that with something else. And it's good to do that because I think there are ways to achieve revenues. Chris raised what I think is an important point, and that is we're having discussions about how we pay for this. And are the municipalities, is Colville going to participate? Is the school district going to participate? Is North Summit Recreation going to participate? Rather than having those discussions after we make this decision on this plan, I think we'd like to know exactly what we're looking at in terms of partnerships and how we could pay for this in the future. And then have some understanding of, from a business plan basis, what are the potential sources of revenue once we get that completed? Because we're not going to build this for a 10-day event.
Yeah. So should those other entities buy-in be required before we move forward here, though?
I think we'd like to see a commitment from them. You know, I don't think it's going to be millions of dollars from any one of those organizations just because they're not wealthy organizations. They have committed to participate on some basis, so I think we'd just like to hear what that is.
Yeah, and I can't figure out what costs so much. I mean, a multi-purpose building, you know, this is not the Taj Mahal, and then animal buildings, I mean, this is an expensive construction.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I was surprised to get the number. When the original $15 million was mentioned to me, I think my response back was, it was 7 to 15 or 8 to 15, something like that. And I said, let's make sure we're on the lower end of that because that seems very expensive. I know that Kim Carson and Tom Fisher and Dave Ewer about a year ago or a year and a half ago went to Sevier County and looked at their fairgrounds. And they built something that was pretty nice for about $7 million. So now that wasn't, you know, I don't know how recent that is, and we want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples, and my guess is it's probably a little bit easier and less expensive to build in Sevier County than it is in Summit County these days. So there's going to be some offsets there, but we want to make sure that we're getting it right and just slow the process a little.
So we're a little bit limited here on the radio to kind of explain the geography, but I mean, we've got, what, basically two parcels split by the Chalk Creek, right?
That's right. And, you know, what's happened in the past is the fair has been concentrated on the parcel to the south or west of the stream, and then it's been primarily parking and camping across the stream. So we bought some of those parcels across the stream, and that's where that expansion is going. So the ball fields and the fairgrounds and fields will continue to be where the current fair has been located. The new multipurpose building will replace what's now the Quonset Hut. And then across the stream will be the rodeo grounds, the warm-up arena. The livestock area will be still on the site that it essentially sort of where it currently is. So it's really expanding the rodeo area into the new purchase area and some of the parking out there.
Right. And that field, mostly just used for parking and camping. So where does all that go then?
Well, it gets pushed out a little bit, and that's part of the problem, is that by expanding into the current parking area and where the fireworks go off, it is where that's all happening today. That winds up being very limited for parking because of the configuration of the rodeo arena and the warm-up. And there's a turnaround in there, so it's very, very limited parking. And then extending beyond that is another field that could be used for parking. And then there's some discussion about possibly entering into agreements with adjacent landowners to use their property for parking during the fair. So I guess that's a possibility. But again, we want to make sure that that's the right way to do this.
Okay. Let's move on. The Community for Children's Justice. This is the group trying to help out the Children's Justice Center. You're actually on the board of this group. So can you describe the situation for them and its current location?
Yeah, this is a group that was established by Susan Richer, and her heart is firmly in the right place on this. So the Children's Justice Center is currently located in the DMV. A few years ago, the only Children's Justice Center we had in the region was in Wasatch County, and there was a decision to separate and make sure that we had a space here. And currently, I think for last year, they saw 80 kids. So most people are surprised at that number because we're talking about children that are victims of child abuse, victims of sexual abuse, possibly domestic violence and other issues. So this is a center where they're brought in. When they come into the justice system, I think the thought process is, let's not take these kids that are going through trauma and take them into an institution like the sheriff's department and put them in a cold room where they're interviewed about what happened. And this reflects the state of the art of the ideal is the state of the art of questioning children and examining them when they've gone through this process so that they can be interviewed on tape, and that tape can be used in a court proceeding so that the kid doesn't have to go through the trauma again of explaining. And they can also get medical care in some of the facilities. There are, I think, 22 of these facilities across the state. Bob Jasper, when he was the county manager, allowed the Children's Justice Center to use some rooms adjacent to the DMV. So these kids were coming in through the DMV waiting line and going into a building that really wasn't designed for it. And if you look around the state at some of the other facilities, they're pretty terrific. Morgan has a nice facility, and they're really designed as homes so that it creates a comfortable atmosphere where the kids have some space to play. There's stuffed animals, there are couches. It's not a cold institutional setting. And ideally, we would like to have a medical practitioner up here that's certified to do the exams, because these are specialized exams and require special medical equipment. So that's what this group is trying to do, is to raise money to be able to build a facility and to equip the facility so that the CJC has appropriate place to operate.
Yeah, well, when you talk about 80 a year, I mean, that's 80 too many, don't get me wrong, yeah. But still, I mean, we're talking about just more than one a week. I mean, why would you need a nurse on call,
I don't know that we'd be on call. Dr. Lasky met with us last night, and I had the opportunity to meet with her with this board a few weeks ago, and she believes that the demand is underreported and understated here, and that if we can build an appropriate facility, we're going to get more reporting. And the demand has been growing. I think as there's outreach and as people understand that they're is a safe place to go, they're reaching out. So I think, and for the lift on this, you know, if we can get a piece of land The Women's Giving Fund has already contributed $30,000 to the group. That will go to buy the equipment and the beds. They're already cleaning out a storage room in the DMV where they can set up an office for medical exams. Dr. Lasky runs that kind of child examination throughout the state from the University of Utah. She's committed to having a medical practitioner up here on at least a part-time basis to deal with those kids. And I, you know, the example that I give is we had a young woman who was raped and came into the system recently. From the time she got into the system until she was finished with the exam down in Salt Lake City, she'd been in the system for 14 hours. And we can't do that. We've got to do better than that when we have kids that are in that kind of trauma.
So any idea where the Children's Justice Center could set up this campus?
Not yet. We're working on it. You know, it seems like, intuitively, it seems like a fairly low lift. If the mission is limited to a facility and we're talking about essentially a 6,000 to 10,000 square foot house, probably someplace in between there, that would have conference rooms, counseling rooms, exam rooms and interview rooms, and maybe a conference room. That's a pretty low lift. People are building houses for that, you know, for under $2 million. And I think that it's the kind of issue that the community will rally around. I mean, we're talking about children that have been hurt.
Yeah. So the population base, of course, here in Summit or in the Snyderville Basin, is that where the majority of the cases are happening, though, or should it be somewhere else in the county?
No, it's not. They're actually coming from countywide. And I think they even get some cases occasionally from Evanston. I know they do. You know, Dr. Lasky actually sees patients from Evanston on occasion. So they're doing good work.
Yeah, but I guess I'm just saying, does it need to be in the Snyderville Basin? Maybe look in Colville where, you know, property values are a little bit cheaper.
I wouldn't take anything off the table. I think having it close to law enforcement, we've got, you know, 8 or 10 investigators. There's a great team that works for both the Park City Police Department and the Summit County Sheriff's Department, and they're doing remarkable work in this area. So I think having it here where those resources are is probably important.
All right. You heard from the Public Works Department in the budget presentation. Any response to that?
No, we've heard a lot of that before. It sounds like we're in fairly good shape. You know, our concern is always when we deal with public works, what do our roads look like? Because if we fall behind, as we've heard so often, with our maintenance of the roads, it's far more expensive to rebuild a road than to maintain it. And Derek gave us some assurances that we're in pretty good shape in that regard.
On a related capital project, the current cell at 3 Mile Landfill is expected to hit capacity in 2018. So how's the county progressing on a new cell?
I'm told that we have conceptual approval of a permit for the new cell. So that permitting process is going forward. We seem to be right on track in terms of the timeline when we expect to exhaust the current cell. So that's going to be moving forward. And we've got some capital in place, and we're going to make sure that we've got the money to pay for it.
All right. Derek Radke also mentioned that the FCC cutting back on broadcast TV channels. So how does that affect any of us with antennas?
I don't know the answer. And I asked that question, and they're going to come back and let us know. They say that when a big event happens, you know, the Super Bowl or something like that, and the television system goes out, they get one or two emails. I suspect there are more than one or two people hooked into the system. I'm also concerned about what it means for us on an emergency management basis. If they narrow, what's happening is that the FCC is talking about narrowing the bandwidth up there. So we just need to know. It was part of the whole budget presentation, so it wasn't deeply discussed, and we'd like to know more about that.
Okay, and you also had a joint meeting with the East Side Planning Commission. Some angst in that meeting, but probably too much to get into at this point. I mean, do you kind of have a Reader's Digest version without getting into the weeds too much?
Yeah, they sent the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission on February 18th provided us with their proposed revisions to Chapters 3 and Chapter 4 of the Eastern Summit County Development Code. And then they went back to work on what's called an MPD process. A plan development process, a master plan development process, so that they could figure out how, if people want to make changes in zoning, if they want to do certain things on the east side, it comes up with a design that's good for the community, good for the landowner. When they handed it up to us in February, they liked that process and really wanted to explore it. They've been working on that since. We've provided our comments on Chapters 3 and 4 to Pat Putt, and we're just waiting for them to complete their process. And it sounds like, you know, much like the their process on the development code changes that they handed up, there's not 100% agreement on what they're doing now. They're wrestling with issues, which is what we expect them to do as members of the Planning Commission. And we're told that sometime by late November, they should be handing that to us. And once we have that, I would expect by January, we should be able to have in front of us a full rewrite and be able to start our process.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
That's all I've got.
All right. Roger, thanks.
Thank you.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong, KPCW News Time, 8:30. Well, tents, gravel, and RV parking topped the list for the Park City Planning Commission meeting last night. In the studio, I have Commissioner Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Real quick, the designers for the Bonanza Park East project gave a brief unscheduled update saying they think they're able to accommodate any of the issues that the city has and will put any and all of the transportation stops that staff wants. So what does that mean for this development? Does it come back to a work session soon?
Yeah, we'll see them again pretty soon. I think we continued this to the 30th of November, which is an unusual meeting for us just because of Thanksgiving. But we decided to have a second meeting that month anyway. I think what they've been doing is working with Matt Castle and Alfred Knox and trying to accommodate, there's a lot of focus on that traffic flow between Bonanza and Kearns and 224. And this there's certainly some issues with what's there now of lots and lots of curb cuts coming in and out. And we're trying to be really careful, we the city and the Planning Commission, to make sure that the flow is improved and we don't have so many problems with people kind of coming in and out of the major thoroughfares. But we didn't get into any detail last night, just more that they'd been working with them and things were going well.
Okay. All those cuts don't help with traffic calming, huh?
No.
I'm just saying, though, because I'm the one who has to pull out onto Bonanza from Prospector. And it's what's nice about it is that when you have a slow-moving car coming out of the Maverick, you know you get to go.
Making a break for you? Yeah, but I tell you, when all it takes is like when one of those trucks is pulling in to unload Twinkies at the Maverick or something and blocks up Bonanza and... and we're certainly, as we look at all the focus on buses and things, that's an area where we really want to make sure we have bus stops so it's convenient to people. And so you got to have cutouts where the buses can pull over and not be stopped in the middle of the road. So there's a lot to think about there. But the nice part is they're thinking about it now.
Okay. The applicant for the North Face building for the Main Street tent wanted to amend the staff recommendation, which would allow the tent up from 12 times a year to 24, but dropping the total number of days from 160 to 106. So sounds like it's a better deal, but you didn't agree?
Yeah, every once in a while I am the odd man out on the Planning Commission, which is a good reason we have seven people. I continue to be a little concerned about any kind of temporary structures on historic Main Street more than any place in the city. And I thought the proposal they had for the tent was fine. I was just concerned about the number of possible events that it could be up during the year. But I think the plan, the nice part is if you know that little alley kind of back beside the North Face building, there's a tree like right off of Main Street there that blocks almost all the view. And so a lot of my concerns about kind of disrupting the old town feel with a tent, if that tree wasn't there, I think it might be a lot different, but I think it'll be almost completely hidden.
So just kind of curious, though, I mean, what kind of events does North Face have? It's a retail shop. They're selling outdoor gear.
Well, I think people are looking for ways to attract folks in different ways. You know, if you just do the standard storefront thing, you're going to get some traffic in and out. But if you can have events where people can come and gather and make it more of a social thing, then I have a feeling they're going to do the same thing as everyone else because there was an exception to that 4-day piece for the Sundance. So, you know, rent it out for Sundance and having that tent next to it would offer some additional space.
Yeah. So this actually did get approved, so they'll be allowed to have it 24 times.
Up to 4 days apiece, and then one time for 10 days, which would be Sundance. And so the nice part is the tent, you know, it has to go up, come down. Generally, it'll be for a 1 or 2 day event, and the 4 days kind of gives them a day to set it up and a day to take it down.
All right. And as you mentioned, I mean, you did have some concern. Just, you know, we've put a lot of money into the reinvestment of Main Street. Still, we've got a tent with the tree in front of it that basically obscures it. How do you feel like that?
I think the idea is if it, I always worry about, you know, in a place where we pay so much attention to, you know, what the windows look like and the door trim looks like and the buildings and the colors and all that kind of stuff, that there's just no way you can really make a tent fit. And yet, you know, we are a resort town. We are event driven. We really do have to accommodate things to have, you know, successful businesses along there. And certainly, you know, we've talked a lot about Main Street having to compete with Kimball Junction and eventually Beaupaw and that kind of thing. So there's just a balancing act between make it look pretty and for the tourist and yet give the businesses an opportunity to really have some first class service.
All right. Then to gravel mulch and parking on landscaped areas. So what do you think the big issues of concern are here?
Well, we're getting there. I think this was just a work session, so we weren't trying to make any decisions. Bruce had kind of taken us through what he saw as the issues and then stepped through the first cut at a proposal. I think we're kind of two separate pieces that end up getting tied together. The gravel mulch thing is something that we've needed to address as part of kind of the xeriscaping, water-saving landscaping issues that are coming up. And I like Bruce's description, which is if you look around town, even in areas that, you know, don't get any watering or anything like that, what you get is native grasses and sage and that kind of stuff. You don't see what you see in a desert where it really does look like gravel and rock and that kind of thing. So when we landscape in town and we have kind of wild, unirrigated areas, we want to make it look like Park City, not look like Arizona. But gravel has a purpose, so we'll fit it in some places.
Yeah, so it is currently allowed. I mean, I've seen a couple of yards that have, or they've done that illegally.
I was going to say, don't distinguish allowed with it exists. Actually, you're not supposed to have gravel in the landscaping today. The thing is, it hasn't become that pervasive. It hasn't been that big a problem. People haven't been complaining about it for the most part. And so the city hasn't really gone after it. And honestly, we weren't really too terribly clear about things with people. So that's part of what we're doing with some of these LMC code amendments is just trying to clarify, you know, have the discussion, have it with the public, give city council an opportunity to kind of shift direction one way or another. And then the ending result should be a more clear code that's easier to enforce.
So what about the houses who have gone to a gravel landscape?
I don't think the city's going to go anywhere to, you know, certainly not my decision, but I don't think the city's going to run out to people and start going, okay, you got to move all your gravel and replace it with something else. But there are places where it does cause problems, where people put it like right up along the street lines and stuff. It ends up getting into the curb. The street sweepers come along, fling it every which way. Lawnmowers pick it up and fire rocks off. And I was even surprised to hear from the city engineer that having gravel right up against the curb, it doesn't give the curb anything solid, and the curbs end up breaking down. So we end up having to replace street curbs more often when the thing behind them is gravel instead of a dirt planting.
Okay. You also heard from Planning Director Bruce Erickson that the city's looking at recreational vehicles being allowed to park in driveways April 1 through November 1, under what conditions?
Yeah, it's kind of some restrictions about where they would end up going. The idea would be that you would be able to put it in as long as you still had alternative parking. I mean, a single-family house needs to have two parking spaces off the street. And as long as you could put your RV in and either through your garage or a big driveway or whatever, still be able to accommodate that, that's fine. What we're seeing is places where people put their RV in their driveway, can't even get to their garage anymore, park all their cars out in the street, and especially when you get into some tight little neighborhoods with like a cul-de-sac or something, all of a sudden you end up with literally a cul-de-sac full of cars that just no one's parking in their driveway because they got a boat or an ATV or an RV or whatever. Also, actually opening up some opportunity for people to park on side yards, because there's a number of houses that don't necessarily have the space in the driveway, but if they could put a parking pad next to their house, they would be able to pull it up there, or even behind the house, again, with some restrictions. We don't want people parking on dirt. We don't want people parking on gravel. That causes problems with some of the things like oil leaks and things like that. So there will be some restrictions, and even on the side yards, there'd be some height restrictions so that you don't have a 14-foot high, you know, Class A monstrosity or something blocking your neighbor's view of the sun. So there will be some restrictions that will affect some people. But in general, I think we'll have a solution that most people will like.
So if those conditions are met, why not just allow them all year long?
The biggest thing is that whenever you put those things in the street or in the driveway, it inevitably ends up with more cars in the street. And as soon as we get to November 1st, we're talking about snow removal. And the more cars you put out in the street, the bigger problems we have.
All right. You also mentioned last night that you were concerned about the number of continuances that have been taking place over the last year. And then on last night's agenda, there were four items continued. So was there some solution here? I mean, maybe just continue the items to an unspecified date so that you bring them back when you're ready for them?
Yeah, the challenge with that, part of the continuances are done, in fact, probably most of them are done because we just run into an issue where when the staff is working with the applicant, either the applicant doesn't have all the materials ready or the staff has some changes that need to be made before it comes to the Planning Commission. And the lead times are pretty restrictive. It's part of the whole, you know, trying to keep everything open to the public and well documented for all our discussions. The agenda gets set pretty early. The package gets set pretty early. The package has to be reviewed and go through legal. And so if all of a sudden, you know, you're 2 weeks into that cycle and the applicant goes, oh, I want to change this. Well, we either go through and do a whole review of something that we know the applicant doesn't want to do, or we just continue it. And I think it's just gotten a little bit worse, partly because, I mean, we've just had such an incredible workload. I mean, everybody's seen the amount of building going on, and then some of the big projects are, you know, taking up a lot of our time and staff's time. But I think part of it is just the planning staff is trying to make sure when we see it, it's in good shape, and they don't want to bring us something that's still in flux.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No. I think it was an easy one.
Okay. Steve, thanks for coming in. Well, the sixth annual Live PC, Give PC happens a week from tomorrow in the studio with details about this year's goals. I have Mike Ruzek, Park City Community Foundation board member and chair of Live PC, Give PC, along with Community Foundation Program Director Ollie Wilder. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mike, we ready to go?
I believe so. We better be. We've got a week and a day left before we hit the sixth annual Live PC, Give PC next Friday, November 4th. So we are excited and raring to go.
Okay, so why are we doing this?
Why are we doing it? Well, I think it comes down to us as a community giving gratitude back to the nonprofits that make this community what it is for us to work, play, raise our families, etc.
Yeah. When you talk about just the specifics of it, though, I mean, there's a 6% fee that's taken out of every donation? Right? I mean, so it would really be better if somebody just gave the money directly to the nonprofit, but that doesn't happen?
Well, in an ideal world, it would be. If we could set up a booth at the bottom of Main Street, that would be great. But, you know, in this day and age, the 6%, half of it goes to credit card fees, and the other half is really part of Razu, the platform for the day. And it really, I don't think it would be possible, quite honestly, without the platform that we have and that we have vetted out through the Park City Community Foundation, who sponsors the event, or puts on the event. So, you know, 6% sounds like a lot, but I'd venture to say that even if you had a gathering at someone's home to try to raise some money as an organization, that would probably cost more than the 6% that you're raising.
All right. So how many nonprofits do we have participating this year?
This year we've got 97 nonprofits participating, even a few more if you count some that are under the wing of other organizations, and that's up from 86 last year. So it's really the more the merrier, too. The more people who are interested in those organizations go to the website, they learn about the other organizations, too.
Yeah. So what are the requirements to participate? I mean, there are other events statewide. But this is for Summit County?
This is for Summit County. You've got to be a 501c3 nonprofit organization active in Summit County and or based in Summit County. So it's folks who are doing things for the good of people here in Summit County. And the money raised through LivePC, GivePC is spent for programs in Summit County.
All right. So the goal this year also going up?
It's $1.5 million this year, up from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 last year. It's not as much of a mouthful, so sounded like a good number. So we're excited with these 94 participating nonprofits to hit that goal next Friday.
Yeah. So how is that goal set and by whom?
We have a committee internally, and there's a little bit of a rounding of large numbers that it's kind of made sense. But you know, we want to keep it to where we can always push ourselves a little bit more year by year.
Yeah, so doable?
I believe so. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And too late for a nonprofit to get into the game at this point?
Sad to say, yep, it's too late. About a week or two ago, we had to finalize the list. We've got to get all our leaderboards set because that's how the nonprofits can qualify for prizes. So if anybody's interested, they're still welcome to get in touch with me for next year. But this year, we've got a pretty full house, and we're excited about that.
All right. So talk a little bit about the leaderboards. What are these, and why are we using them?
One of the ways that we help nonprofits encourage folks to give to them is by offering prizes for the most donors that a nonprofit gets. So, for example, we've got an all-nonprofits leaderboard that's sponsored by Park City Mountain and Epic Promise. They're our presenting sponsors for the whole event. And whoever the top three organizations in terms of number of donors, not amount of giving, but number of donors, win prizes ranging from $1,000 to $2,500. We've also got five this year themed leaderboards. So even if you're not the big guy who wins the all-nonprofits leaderboard, you've still got a shot at something in your category. So we've got a social services one, arts and culture, sports, environment, education, and each of those it has a sponsor. And the prizes for those leaderboards range from $500 to $1,250 for first, second, and third place. And so there's a really good shot. There are 18 prizes, and so a lot of nonprofits will qualify for these and can actually win some extra money based on getting a lot of donors.
All right. I know a number of organizations also have matching grants. How do those figure into all of this?
Absolutely. There are donors who want to support an organization in being successful, and so they'll put up maybe $500 or $1,000. In some cases, there are organizations with over $10,000 in matching grants, and they match one-to-one donations that come in online. So if you're a donor thinking about giving, as like as not, your dollar given will be matched by a matching grant.
So is that information on each of their pages so that you know that?
Yes. If you go now to livepcgivepc.org, search for your favorite organization and click on their page, it'll show whether they have an active matching grant or not. Many of them are holding off till the actual day of giving. You can give now, and it does count, but the big day is Friday, November 4th. And on that day, too, on the main homepage, there will be a place where you can click to see all the available matching grants. That won't be appearing until the day of, but even now, you can go to an individual page and check it out.
Any idea how many people have made pledges already?
Not totally sure. Haven't looked at that yet. Last year, we got a pretty good running start. It was well over $100,000 that people gave early, which is awesome. But to get to $1.5 million, it's going to take a lot more than that. And we just are counting on everybody to go to livepcgivepc.org and give.
Okay. And you also have kind of what, a gathering after it's all over? Tell me about that.
So on Friday evening at High West Saloon, I guess it used to be Distillery, but that's out at... Blue Sky Ranch. We're having a community gathering, as we've had the last few years. Myself and Bill Rock will be co-MCs of that event, and it's just a great time for all of us in town to come together and celebrate, hopefully, a victory that afternoon or that evening. I believe it's at 7 o'clock.
Seven to midnight. Yeah, so everybody should remember to give first, and then if they'd like to, come hang out at the celebration with us that evening on Friday, November 4th.
And if by chance you hadn't had a chance to give by that point in time, then we'll have some donation stations there as well.
All right, so cash bar and then a little bit of food or something? Is that what's planned?
Yes.
Exactly, 21 plus because it's where it is, and but cash bar and, yep, some food. And last year it was really packed, so come check it out.
Okay, anything else, guys, you need to mention?
Just thanks so much to everybody for supporting all these nonprofits that do all this good in the community.
And Okay. Thanks to KPCW as well. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks. November 4th, Live PC, Give PC. D1 now, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The University of Utah's Marriott Library will be honoring two legacies that have made Utah a winter sport and recreation destination at the 26th annual Ski Affair next week. In the studio is one of these year's recipients, Colin Hilton, the director of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation receiving the History Maker Award for maintaining three Olympic legacy venues, the Utah Olympic Park here in Park City, Soldier Hollow Nordic Center in Midway, and the Utah Olympics Oval in Kearns. Congratulations. So this is going to be bestowed on you next Tuesday?
Yep, Tuesday night, November 1st, down at the Little America one of two recipients receiving awards that night. And again, I think the fun for me has been it's really made me reflect on why our Olympic legacy has been very successful and what we're doing today, being four times busier with our Olympic venues than we were right after the O2 Games. And it's really because of a series of great decisions made over a series of years, starting and dating all the way back to the late 80s.
All right. So tickets to the event still available?
Yes, they are. And again, they're $75 a person and can be found online and purchased at tinyurl.com/skiaffair, tinyurl.com/skiaffair. And they expect somewhere about 500 people.
Wow. Okay. And then also the another award being made Tuesday, and that's to the former owner of Solitude.
Gary DeSeelhorst, who was really guided Solitude through the late 70s to just last year before Deer Valley took them over. And so he and all of the efforts of his family to make that successful will be recognized as well.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit about the library ski archives? I graduated from the U before the archives were founded in 1989.
Yeah.
But they're open to everyone, yeah?
It is. It's a great thing. The J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah is the official group, and they operate the Utah Ski Archives. And they're very tied in with also County Nelson at the Alfangen Ski History Museum and the annual Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame awards that are done. So these are folks who are helping, who are winter sport enthusiasts, who are recognizing over the years all the great efforts that either individuals or organizations are making to that effort.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the venues that you oversee. As we've talked about before, these are capital-hungry complexes. Are you keeping them up to date?
Absolutely. And that is, you know, been really a difference in the world for a post-Olympic city to continue to maintain at a world-class level their facilities for athlete training and holding events. A lot of countries have let their facilities run down after a games or don't have a plan for them. And I think that is really what attracted me to be involved in our Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation. I had been 20 years of being a part of these major events that were three-week big celebrations of, you know, competitions for just a small period of time. And it always kind of bugged me how much money were spent on those events without a lot of thought of what to do with the facilities afterward. And Utah really is setting the most sustainable legacy story in the entire world, and we're in the midst of doing that. And this recent prompting for this event coming up really has made me become a history buff to really dive back in to looking at the story of how the Olympics came to Utah and what were the decisions and who were involved from the late 80s through the 90s to plan how the structure was for our foundation and the legacy story we have going today.
Yeah, one of the best stories is Soldier Hollow.
Absolutely.
In terms of how we found
and,
that. Mm-hmm.
And Howard Peterson, who was the leader in that effort, along with the state parks, Cortland Nelson.
And McKay Edwards.
Yep, absolutely. There was a great effort to plan that when it wasn't going to work down in Parley's Canyon at Mountain Dell, and it got shifted over to Soldier Hollow. And so Howard not only planned the leadership of Soldier Hollow venue, but he actually was a driving force. He was heading up USSA back in the early 90s and really shifted the U.S. Olympic Committee's thought towards planning training facilities for athletes to build them as a permanent facility and plan for their post-games operation. So Howard not only did that, but he oversaw the original the original thoughts of how to build the Utah Winter Sports Park and to build this freestyle training pool, which, as you know, we've gone through a renovation because it's so busy. So there is a series of folks who Charlie Winsor locally was very involved in helping to select the site and helping to oversee the construction of the Utah Olympic Park. And Brad Ulch and Ian Cumming was very much, he was on the board of the Utah Sports Authority, which was the state agency building the original Winter Sports Park, and folks like, obviously, Fraser Bullock, Randy Dreyer, Gordon Strong locally here, all very involved in not only shaping us to win the games, but to think about what you do after the games with these facilities.
Well, the upkeep and maintenance of these have been paid for with money from a legacy endowment. So that still remains intact?
Yes, and was thought of back in 1994. There was a state resolution done in 94 to say there should be a legacy foundation. It should pay back the state the original $59 million investment to build the Olympic facilities. And it should leave, at a minimum, a $40 million endowment. That was thought of in 1994. And then in 02, after a successful games, the organizing committee of the games paid back the state the $59 million and then left a $76 million endowment for our foundation to keep running these Olympic venues that any businessman would never run because they have to be subsidized, and it requires those investment earnings from our endowment.
Well, congratulations, because you've done a good job. They're very popular venues.
Well, and it's been a conscious decision to say that they're not just elite athlete training facilities, but they are all ages, all abilities. They are community recreation centers, and that's been our secret recipe.
Well, we certainly knew what with the freestyle pool facility last year. What about Soldier Hollow? I mean, there are a lot of work needed to be done there. Has that been done?
Yes, and our foundation is just this year getting involved to take over where Howard and others had really kept it going. They had a break-even operation, but it had a lot of deferred maintenance. So we've come in, we secured about $500,000 of funds from the last legislative session to help give a little bit of impetus, and we're continuing to do that. And we're now going to be hosting the largest event in Soldier Hollow since the O2 Games, and that is the Junior World Championships at the end of January. Roughly 1,000 athletes under age of 23 from all around the world coming in to have cross-country skiing and Nordic combined events right here in Summit County and Wasatch County.
Okay, well, we need snow, but you also have snowmaking there, right?
We do, and that's been sort of our ability to help train the early jumps of our athletes here. Cold temps, we're looking for those right now, and we'll get those jumps up and going for the athletes who are training for this winter.
Yeah, is the ice on the track yet, on the bobsled track?
Yep, the bobsled track has been a week of building the ice, and it is opening very shortly. I don't know the exact date, but within a few days.
Okay. Hey, Colin, thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.